Greetings, good afternoon, and a warm welcome to all listeners of this Spring Socialist Network podcast. My name is Loretta Fisher, and I have the pleasure today of interviewing our special guest, Paul Taylor. Paul is the executive director of Foodshare Toronto, and he's also a lifelong anti-poverty activist, helping our communities challenge unfair systems that produce food insecurity. Paul Taylor is currently the federal NDP candidate for the riding of Parkdale High Park. Congratulations, Paul, on your nomination. We can't wait to hear more about the amazing work you do for social justice and what Spring listeners can do to support you. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We hope you enjoy this interview. I really, really wanted to thank you and wish you a good day and first congratulate you on your nomination by the NDP.
Thank you so much.
You were nominated by the NDP. I'm so glad. And it's only recently that I just heard from James that you were also nominated last year and ran last year.
Indeed.
No, not last year, 2019.
Absolutely.
So I guess you were a popular candidate then, and they didn't want to lose you. So you got a second nomination. This is really great.
Thank you.
Really wish you all the best. Everyone at Spring does, for sure. Oh,
thank you. That means a lot. I really appreciate that.
I think right now it's probably time to turn this spotlight on you and hope you can answer a few questions for Spring today.
You bet.
So, Paul, you're obviously a high achiever, as we've seen in your career until now. You are an activist and a self-proclaimed community builder. So why did you make this decision to run for politics? And what do you hope to achieve as an MP?
That's a great question. I would say, I guess in retrospect, I'm pretty certain that I probably made that decision to do, you know, to do everything in my power to make life better for people at a really young age. And in fact, I was 13 years old when I recognized that the choices that politicians make have significant impacts on our lives. You know, when Mike Harris was elected Premier of Ontario, I was 13. And one of the first things he did was he cut welfare by 22% at the same time that he also decreased taxes. And you know, as being raised by a single mom, a powerful Black woman, you know, an immigrant, single Black woman who did everything she could to make life better for my brother and I, had been forced to struggle. That was the first time I saw her cry. So that was, for me, a pretty profound moment. Mm. And our family struggled because that government, you know, ultimately was at war with the poor, and we were materially poor. And shortly after those cuts to welfare, we had much less food. We had the electricity cut off, the heat cut off, which also meant that we didn't have water. And I know that there are people in this country who are suffering even more than my family did as a child, when I was a child. And there are people without food, a home, or have been denied access to clean drinking water or the medicines that they need. So I think that moment was really important to me. And what I learned from those Mike Harris cuts is that that was a choice that he made and that they didn't have to be that way. So I think I've spent my entire life doing what I can to make life better for folks, especially those most neglected by our systems, institutions, and governments. And actually, if I could just share one little story. Something a friend of mine, just an old high school friend, reminded me that, and I had completely forgotten about this, but before exams, I used to host classes after school where we went through course material and we prepped for the exams, and those classes were packed. And it was packed with, you know, Black kids on the basketball team, friends whose families had just moved here as they fled war. And I just know that I felt this keen sense of justice, and I didn't want my friends to get left behind. So that, you know, I don't want anyone to get left behind. And I know, because I know what that feels like. I know what that injustice feels like. And, you know, that lens and that approach to doing what I can to make things better for folks, that's why I decided to run for office. I think we need to make sure that folks who have been left behind and left out and harmed the most are at the front and center in the work of rebuilding a society that works for us all.
That is really profound. At the age of 13, you were very cognizant of the effect that the policies we're having.
Mm-hmm.
Directly.
Yeah. it was the beginning of that, I would say, for me, you know, definitely the beginning of that, because I didn't understand why a politician would want to make my mom cry and make life harder for us. So I asked a lot of questions and got really angry.
Yes. And another thing I hear in your answer is that you had a heart for all the other families that you realized that were going through similar things, if not worse. Wow. So how do you see the relationship between being a longtime community activist and running for the NDP? What do you see as the division of labor between being a community activist and now throwing your hat into politics?
I love that question. That's a funny one. That's the same kind of question I think many folks first asked me when I started at FoodShare. You know, how can I reconcile my activism? We often think about activism as something that happens way over there, away from all of the other happenings of society. You know, and people said, yeah, how can I reconcile my activism with the work, with working at an institution, you know, a charity? Well, the way I see it is that there shouldn't be any of that division at all. You know, we've allowed these divisions to occur and take root in the same way that we can dismantle these divisions that I think ultimately halt our progress. I think what we need to do is really continue to build a movement for justice that includes oppressed communities, but it also needs to include social movements, community organizations, nonprofit, labor, and even faith communities. Because I think we need to start recognizing how much we have in common instead of emphasizing what we don't agree on. Because while we do that, we've let the richest people in our society and massive corporations get away with murder. You know, the slow murder that is poverty wages, the slow murder that is extractive capitalism, it's destroying our planet. The slow murder of our collective belief that something better is possible. You know, they're working hard to convince us that transformational social change isn't possible, and they're wrong. So I think we'll win when we work together and leverage our greatest asset. It's people power, a broad movement of people committed to working for justice in all of its forms, be it racial justice, climate justice, gender justice, disability justice, migrant justice, economic justice, you know, the justice that we've been denied for far too long.
Absolutely. That is a great answer because of the fact that you pointed out that it's not a division of labor after all. You made clear that it's all about being inclusive and you pointed out the intersectionality of all of those issues that you just mentioned. So I just want to know next if you, with your vast experience working bringing to light these wide-ranging social issues, do you think the NDP can become more open to the goals of socialist movements and our demand for human rights?
Yeah, I think it's our party, and we need to continue to be involved to ensure that it does. You know, these are democratic institutions, political parties. But I also acknowledge that I heard, you know, when I reflect on the most recent convention, I heard some important criticisms that I think we need to listen to those criticisms because they're important and it's coming from our members. And I think ultimately those criticisms and making change based on what we've heard will make us better. You know, so I think as a progressive party, as a movement, we must always prioritize accessibility and center disability justice in our organizing. Otherwise, we're just reinforcing ableism. So that's something I really took away loud and clear that I'll continue to advocate for. But I'm also proud to be a member of a party filled with bold, unapologetic socialists, willing to engage in rigorous debate about how we do that, about how we advance justice, you know, and everything from, you know, taking a bold position in support of Palestine to questioning the validity of billionaires, solidarity with indigenous land back movements, and I think big conversations around the potential for public ownership. And as a progressive and socialist movement, I think we need to continue to be bold and to fight back against the lack of imagination about what's possible for this country. And, you know, I benefited a lot from, you know, some of the lessons I learned from my mother. You know, I often reflect that, you know, as a Black man in a position of leadership now, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the labor of Black women who are the folks who keep our communities nourished and fed and supported and who push back against the low expectations that sometimes society bestows upon us. And one of the things my mother used to say is that change doesn't happen overnight. And I think she's right. You know, we'll get there. We just can't lose sight of what's possible. You know, a country that we can all be proud of, one that has justice as our North Star and that stands up for human rights, both domestically and internationally.
Absolutely. And we just can't lose sight of momentum in the fight either. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that you mentioned your mom, because you have mentioned her before in this discussion, but it's just that the lessons that you learned from her, I'm just very proud, you know, that she was able to impart this to you, and very proud mm-hmm. of you that you, internalized it. But also mm-hmm. there is another woman in your life that you happen to put her picture up on LinkedIn. I believe this was your grandmother. Mm-hmm. And I was really, really impressed. It just brought tears to my eyes, actually, to see you honor her that way and to acknowledge that was the way that your grandmother kind of felt a responsibility for feeding people around her, not just her own family, but her community. Mm-hmm. Yes, that was amazing. Did you want to say something about that?
Sure. Yeah. Those lessons live in me. You know, they are what make me do what I do. And like I say, I feel like Black women do so much of the heavy lifting. I think about my mother, my grandmother, my great grandmother, so much of the heavy lifting in our communities, and they're often uncelebrated. So I try to seize every opportunity I can to express my gratitude for the hard work and the labor of Black women that allow me to be able to lead and fight for justice in the way that I do. You know, I feel like I've been passed a baton. You know, I think about all of the courageous, badass leaders that came before me, who, you know, have fought to advance justice. And my goal is to take that baton and to hold it with as many people as I possibly can, and to run as fast as I can and as far as we can, so that we can pass that baton on to others who are going to continue the fight for justice. And each time we are going to take big, bold jumps towards the justice that we all know is possible.
Yes. Thank you so much for taking on that baton. Because I believe that baton has become a little bit heavier with the devastating impacts of this COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, the pressing issues that have been exposed by capitalism. What are you doing now in preparation to address these heavier key issues and make them priorities?
Well, you know, there are big issues, and I think the pandemic has revealed a lot. And one of the things I've taken away from this is that, you know, we often don't hear politicians speaking about communities like the disabled community. And I think that, and as a result, disabled Canadians have been consistently left behind. You know, I've heard folks in my community that are disabled say that they've felt neglected and unsupported by this government, and it's not just the pandemic. You know, the issues that folks are facing, disabled Canadians are facing, are systemic and have been exacerbated by the pandemic. You know, on Thursday evening, I had a Zoom call with a disability justice activist in my community who spoke to me about the frustrations of folks having to try to survive on ODSP, as across the country and in every press conference, Justin Trudeau is making these announcements about CERB and rolling out CERB and acknowledging that it's $2,000 that is what's going to help folks, which is so much more than folks who are on ODSP and other disability income supports across the country receive. I also think, you know, this pandemic has without a doubt made racism more visible to those that have tried to ignore it or those that have been allowed to ignore it for far too long. Mm-hmm. You know, we've demonstrated that tackling anti-Black racism isn't about a one-day workshop or a Black square on Instagram. It's about looking at our organizations to identify how anti-Black racism and white supremacy show up. That's what we've been able to do at Food Share. My colleagues and I, I'm really proud of that work. It's work that we've been committed to. And, it's inspired things like the development of our organizational combating anti-Black racism action plan that we've posted on our website. And it includes deadlines and accountability measures. You know, these are things that this is the way that I've worked. You know, the pen and actually I'll also say one other thing. Sorry for jumping around a little bit.
That's okay.
But the pandemic has also received that. I just keep thinking about our essential workers. Mm-hmm. And this pandemic has revealed that essential workers in lots of ways are essential in name only. Our governments have refused to legislate employers to provide the support that these workers need, things like paid sick days. You know, in provinces, in Ontario for sure, but in provinces right across the country, essential workers are putting their lives at risk without adequate paid sick days. They're most likely also to be paid poverty wages, especially if they're racialized. You know, we've also seen the few employers that offered temporary pandemic pay bumps roll them back as soon as they possibly could. And to me, it seems like much of this has been more like a PR stunt than any kind of actual support or honoring of workers. And again, no legislation introduced to protect these workers. So FoodShare, you know, where I'm the executive director, has had a very different approach to supporting our essential workers. And firstly, it starts with a deep respect and appreciation for the risk that my colleagues are taking and have been taking since the onset of the pandemic to deliver good food boxes to families that order them right across the city. But they've also been delivering emergency good food boxes, which has allowed FoodShare to provide over 2 million pounds of free produce to folks struggling the most to access food as a result of the pandemic. So from the onset, we started that and we immediately said our essential work, we reminded them of their right to refuse unsafe work. We bumped their wages up by $4 an hour and we never stopped that. In fact, what we did is we transitioned that increase into a permanent livable wage. So we're now an official member of the Ontario Living Wage Network, which means FoodShare's minimum wage is now, you know, $22.08. And we're committed to indexing it to make sure that it remains livable. And, you know, at the onset of the pandemic, the need for additional paid sick days was clear, almost as clear as, you know, the fact that what we saw, the jurisdictional government finger pointing, wasn't going to achieve much, especially with a stubborn premier like we've got in Ontario and a prime minister that seems more focused on slogans than policy. So we immediately introduced an additional 10 days of paid sick days last year and then added another 10 in 2021. We knew that some of our colleagues were struggling with, you know, access to care as well. So we also provided folks with 24 additional days off if they were struggling to provide care for a children or a family member during the pandemic. So maybe I'll say one other thing that I think has been really important to our approach. We believe in challenging income inequality, and it's not something that we just talk about. It's something that we actually do within the organization as well. So we have a policy that actually connects the rate of pay for the lowest paid worker to that of the highest paid worker. It's a 1-to-3 ratio. So that means that the highest paid worker, me, can make no more than 3 times what the lowest paid worker makes. And again, these lessons and this commitment to justice and recognizing and honoring who's on the front lines, who's risking the most, you know, all of the many of these lessons really come from my mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother. And like I said, I've spent my entire life using my power and the resources available to me to do what I can to make life better for folks, especially for those that have been made to struggle the most as a result of government neglect. And that's exactly the type of member of parliament that I plan to be.
Wow, that is exactly the kind of member of parliament that we need, one that puts their money where their mouth is. I mean, I'm just talking about specifically what you just said about your employees, mm-hmm. you know, and is it called the permanent living wage that you have afforded them?
That absolutely.
That is definitely, you know, not just, it's not just talk, that's doing it. And then I think you also just mentioned that they also have 10 paid sick days and then another 10?
Yeah, so actually they started with, I think it's 18 paid sick days. So not only did we add another 10, but we recognized that people are going to get sick outside of the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic. So this was 10 paid sick days on top of that last year. And then in 2021, this year, we did the exact same thing and added another 10 because we weren't going to wait. We couldn't wait. Our colleagues couldn't wait for the governments to figure out what they were going to do. We needed to make sure that we were doing everything we could to keep people safe. And I think we need politicians like that. It's so disappointing. It's so disappointing that we, you know, our movements have to spend so much of our energies fighting for, you know, respect for workers who are essential. To me, it's really disappointing.
It is disappointing. And I find that that is something that comes up again and again when we're dealing with parties who are working under capitalism. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in light of the recent struggles of our BIPOC politicians, from Selena Cesar Chavanes resigning from the Liberals to Jagmeet Singh being expelled from the House of Commons for calling out racism, to Annamie Paul leading the Green Party right now, is it possible to prepare yourself, Paul, to fight the inevitable racism that will come your way? Can you find real allies to back you up with the truth that it's not calling someone a racist that should be punished, but it's the practice of racism in politics and everywhere that should be kicked out?
Oh, absolutely. I love that question. And this is real experience for folks. You know, we talk about having more racialized people elected. I think we need more progressive racialized people elected. But, you know, we talk about that, but we never really talk about what needs to happen to make the House of Commons, to make being a politician accessible and safe for racialized folks. So I'm really fortunate because I've had the opportunity and I would say deep pleasure to get to know some of our racialized progressive MPs, folks like Leah Kazan, Matthew Green, and of course, you know, the leader of the NDP, Jagmeet Singh. And they are folks that have consistently stood up for racial justice and challenged the very existence of race-based inequities. And I think we'll only start to see change at the policy level if more MPs are in the House fighting for racial justice every day. So I'm grateful for them and the work that they're doing right now and the leadership that they're displaying on challenging racism that should be a priority for every political party and member of parliament. And, you know, when I was a kid, I remember catching glimpses of leaders' debates on the news as a child. And to me, it seemed it was always white folks debating away. I was almost certain at that point that politics was something that was only for white people. So I think we need to continue to dismantle that myth by further diversifying parliament and electing more leaders willing to stand up for justice, which includes pushing back on the way that governments have been centered around white supremacy. And even, you know, more recently, middle of the roadism and the protection of the status quo. We get a lot of that from this current government in particular. And I think that's absolutely not what we need. And actually, it's harmful if we continue to see that kind of leadership.
I think there was another day I was surfing the agenda, and I saw some Black politicians who happened to be from the Conservative Party. I don't know the names at the moment. It was the first time I'd seen them, but I was very disappointed to hear at least one, if not more, of them talking about the fact that they thought that usually Black people are talking or speaking from the standpoint of being a victim. And I thought that was so inappropriate of them to say something like that, because of the fact that it's like totally ignoring the fact that there has been a war on the poor, war on the disabled, a war on, you know, these people that you mentioned that who nobody ever said, oh yeah, maybe it does take $2,000 to be able to support yourself. Nobody thought about them, right? Mm-hmm. And then we're going to have Black politicians in the Conservative Party say that for some reason we're always talking as if we're victims, and they wish that Black people would stop that. You didn't see that, right? I'm going to have to look that up again.
I didn't see that. But, you know, it completely ignores the fact that the issues that have been bestowed upon racialized folks are systemic. You know, Black Canadians are 3.5 times more likely to be food insecure than white folks. But it's not because we're Black. It's because the systems have been rigged against us.
Exactly.
So I wish that it wasn't the Conservatives, for example, that stopped building affordable housing in this country, and then the Liberals followed suit. But, you know, these are the systems that have harmed and inflicted further violence on our communities. So that's really disappointing to hear, but unfortunately, I'm not surprised.
It was, but I feel that going forward, we can have they can have different parties on instead of all of the one party on at the same time. We could have so that you could. I was basically wishing that you were there to refute that. Just the way you did. And
I think it's important.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up.
And now you did get the very last question I sent you, right?
I did, yes.
Number six?
Yes.
Number six. Okay, great. As activists and longtime activists, we're drawn to so many of the same causes, whether as members of Spring or the NDP. And many activists, both inside and outside the NDP, are calling on the party to put forward a platform of bold proposals for the upcoming federal election. What role, Paul, do you think you could play to help the NDP advance a bold and ambitious vision for social justice?
Well, I think what grounds me and what's always grounded me is knowing who I am and what I've always fought for in any space that I'm in. And it's bold, progressive change rooted in social justice. That's who I am as a person. That's who I am as the executive director of Food Share. And that's the kind of MP that I'll be. You know, I think bold progressive change isn't going to be won just because it's promised in an election platform. It's going to happen when we continue to focus our energies on building a broad-based movement for progressive change. We're only going to be able to do that if we engage and prioritize, I think, folks that have been made most vulnerable by our current systems. You know, as I mentioned, disabled Canadians, gig workers, women, the queer community, migrants, Indigenous people, you know, and this is work that happens outside of elections. It's movement work. It's the ongoing listening, the exchange of ideas and experiences, the building and a commitment to solidarity. It's showing up in tangible ways for those same communities that bear the brunt of inequity. That's the work that I've long been committed to, and I won't work any differently once I'm elected.
That is very clear. That is great. The follow-up question is, when political parties develop their platforms, they usually rely on polling and focus groups to choose their top election promises. But that approach has its limits. It doesn't challenge the status quo where it needs to be challenged, merely follows it. How could the upcoming federal election be an opportunity to improve public opinion on issues that matter to activists? For example, how could the campaign help the public to get a better understanding of the reality of anti-Black racism?
Yeah, I think it's all of those things that I just described, you know, election promises. I think we really need to contextualize them. And I think they're just a small number of commitments, especially when you consider the wide range of issues and policies that a political party takes positions on in between elections. I think elections are absolutely important, but they've been constructed in some ways as the be-all and end-all. So it's the time in between election cycles that we make that we need to make more proposals. But it's also where we have that time to the time and opportunity to explain why some of the positions that we've taken are critical to tackling things like anti-Black racism or any of the horrible things that we're working to defeat. You know, when we're talking about farmer care, when we're talking about building affordable housing, when we're talking about challenging poverty, you know, all of these things, I think we need to bring back to also seizing opportunities to educate and to share information from the communities, again, that have had to, you know, bear the effects of this, you know, continued neoliberalism and these inequities that have been allowed to fester.
Exactly. And I apologize if some of my questions have been overlapping. While you were responding, I just wanted to know what you thought about the Status for All campaign.
I'm a huge supporter of the Status for All campaign. Actually, you know, I consider myself an internationalist, and I think, you know, I spend a lot of time advocating for human rights. And I think it's really important that in our thinking about human rights, they don't end at borders. You know, we need to be thinking about human rights both domestically and internationally, and we need to be able to challenge some of the systems like the Migrant Agricultural Worker Program and some of these other programs that have allowed for, you know, the ultimately racism to exist within immigration policy and the like. So I'm a huge supporter of the Status for All campaign.
Thank you, Paul. So am I.
It's time for migrant justice. It's time for all of the different forms of justice that I think, you know, we've been convinced aren't possible. I get excited because I think more people, I don't know if it's the pandemic or just enough people are fed up, but I think more people are coming to the conversation and recognizing that actually so much more is possible than what we've been sold by, you know, previous liberal and conservative governments. And I think people are ready to really fight hard for those things. And I know I certainly am.
Yes. I think that, I literally think that every Black person should be a socialist for one thing. I myself did not realize that I was a socialist until the summer of 2019. In the summer of 2019, after I had been working with the Workers Action Center, being a member and then taking leadership programs and taking organizing programs and just getting deeper and deeper into the Workers Action Center and learning how to stand up for rights and stand up alongside others. Being there and actually being there when we actually did win the 15, and then, but then it was taken away. So I am, you know, very deep into that campaign and so on. Mm-hmm. I believe I was at a rally downtown near the museum.
Okay.
And it was summertime and we were making our chants about justice. And when there was a lull, somebody on the sidewalk yelled over, "So what do you want? What do you want? Everybody just to be effing socialists or something?" Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized that's exactly what I wanted to be. And then it was like a couple of weeks later, somebody from Spring asked me if I wanted to join. So they had no idea that that had happened to me. Wow. It was just that's when I said, okay, yeah, I'm ready, because I had heard of Spring long before that, because we are affiliated with Spring, WAC and Spring and, you know, MWAC and, you know, and the child's, the one that child care, I'm not sure the initials now, CAC maybe. Too many acronyms for me.
I know. Well, I'll say that I'm also a huge fan of the work of the Workers Action Center. Dina and I've done some work together, and I think it's so critical. So thank you for the work that you do. And I'll also say that, you know, I think one of the only good thing I can take from Mike Harris, or I can say that he inspired, probably in me and several, definitely me and hopefully in several others, but he is the person that made me a socialist. The Common Sense Revolution, or the so-called Common Sense Revolution, and Mike Harris are definitely what made me a socialist.
Aha, perfect. Oh my goodness. No, that is perfect, that he was good for something then. At that
Exactly. Oh, this has been such a good conversation, Loretta. It's really nice to connect like this.
Yes, it's been great, Paul.
Thank you so much.
Have a wonderful weekend, Paul.
You as well. You take care.
We'll be in touch. Right. Bye.
You bet. Bye for now.
It has been a real pleasure speaking with Paul Taylor on this Spring podcast and learning more about his motivations, his career, and his views about how to improve conditions for working people across the country. We wish you all the best, Paul, in the upcoming federal election, and we look forward to supporting your work in the social movements. And thank you again, listeners, for tuning in. You can find an edited version of this interview on the Spring website at springmag.ca. See you again soon.